You're listening to the Replatform podcast, sponsored by Attract and Hypersonics, hosted by me, James Gerd, and Paul Rogers. Today is part two of our podcast with Jonathan from Loop Returns. We are drilling down into customer experience considerations for your e-commerce return strategy. If you missed part one, you can catch up on our website. We hope you to enjoy today's episode.
And how do you see the state of returns today versus the last few years? Do you see that it's increased a lot, which I think was a trend a couple of years ago, or do you think it's changed since then? And yeah, how do you see this changing in the future?
Yeah, totally. So we certainly let, I think, data tell the story. And I think, what we've seen is at a macro level in e-com, e-commerce is still growing and our merchants are still growing, but the growth is far less than it was through 2020 and 2021. That's probably not a shock to anybody. But when we look back at some of those numbers, and again, I'll talk with accuracy over precision here. You know, we saw something like 70, 80% year-over-year growth for our merchants 2021 from 2020. We saw something like 40, 50% 2022 to 21. And this year we're seeing something like 8 or 9%. So there is still e-commerce growth in our merchant segment with the merchants we serve. Returns as a percentage of sales are stable and increasing, though it's very stable. I guess when I think of like the state of returns, what I'm observing is there is more of a merchant appetite, but a little bit of fear. There's more of a merchant appetite to charge a handling fee for all returns, all exchanges, et cetera. And there's a fear that the customer expectation is set so firmly on free returns, free exchanges, that will diminish the quality of the shopper merchant relationship. What we've seen, I mean, we can look at like the merchants who have decided to implement a handling fee of, $4.99 to process any return, or $4.99 if you want a refund. And what's, nice for merchants, I think, is that with real empirical data, we can say that there's negligible, if any, change in shopper behavior based on the inclusion of a fee, which if I just like zoom out of like not just sort of zero sum unit economics and more into just like, what does that say? I think what that says is shoppers prefer to buy from brands, from independent brands, from modern retailers. And if they're given a great experience, they're willing to pay a premium for it. And there is actually a little bit of a shared destiny and a partnership where I think maybe shoppers have realized that if they want these modern brands that they love to exist, they need to support them, and that there's a willingness to have a little bit of a quid pro quo in that return and exchange world that maybe merchants didn't know about before, or maybe was a little bit different in the earlier days of Amazon sort of leading the charge of, hey, we're going to do free returns and free exchanges. And therefore, if that expectation is set there, everyone else like has to do it. And I think what we're seeing these days is that shoppers really want to buy from these independent brands, and they're willing to, with their dollars, vote and support those brands to help make sure that the economics of a return and exchange just work for the merchant so that brand continues to be there for years to come when they want to buy their products.
That's a really important point to tease out, because I think that mantra that people have had for so long of, Amazon does it, we've got to catch up, is a totally different model and a totally different set of motivations of why people buy direct from a brand, especially if you have a brand that's got specific values, maybe ethical, environment, whatever they might be, that people buy into. So I like that. It's really nice to hear that actually there are people doing this and not finding it have a detrimental impact on the retention, which is where people always panic that we charge for returns, we'll lose them. And you've talked about charging of handling fees and that people are doing it. What I'd love to know is what strategies are you seeing work best? Because, you've got a blanket one where we're going to charge for everything versus brands where they might be more granular and target specific types of orders, specific products, specific locations, or even specific customer types. What are you seeing really working for merchants out there?
Yeah. Thanks, James. I'll go back to sort of, I mentioned like a first level of automation and a second level of sort of optimization or personalization. And I think we certainly are seeing that everybody's sort of got to do more with less. And so the automation is step one. And, you know, any and every merchant is going ahead and setting their standards. With Loop, we're certainly seeing merchants take some really baseline steps. An example would be new versus returning customers, or a different behavior on a first or second order than a third or fourth or fifth. And like, this is, again, I'll take broad swaths here, or like sledgehammers, not scalpels, but like there's a dramatic difference in the value of getting a customer to buy a second time than a third or fourth or fifth. Like for many brands, once you've gotten a customer to place a second order, that second order is often the most valuable order you can place. And so what our workflows engine does is, you know, based on some of those customer criteria. So like imagine customer returning a first order they've ever placed. We can help merchants decide to charge a fee, not charge a fee, charge a different fee, offer faster or slower shipping on the outbound exchange, offer a different shipping method on the return, different sort of drop-off points, all that sort of stuff. But maybe it's almost like, what happens on the first order, what happens on the second order, and what happens on the third order? And those are sort of three maybe baseline levels of sort of personalization where merchants can set those criteria. And then I'll pick on us on Loop a little bit too, is maybe it feels like everyone's behind the times with artificial intelligence these days, but our workflows are still like dumb and need set by a person. And, you know, 12 months from now, we need to be able to automate and intelligently, if not set outright, make very clear recommendations to merchants that, hey, based on your average order value, your repeat purchase rate, your customer lifetime value targets, and some other criteria you've set, we believe that you should be charging these fees to these customers in these scenarios on these products and on these order values. And just like making that something merchants can confidently and easily access and leverage and understand the benefit of. Candidly require a little bit too much burden on the merchant to make those decisions today for my liking and for what I think we should be doing going forward.
Attract, your complete product discovery growth engine. Create relevant shopping experiences that convert into sales and grow online revenue with personalized search, merchandising, and recommendation solutions powered by AI. Find out more at attract.com.
And I guess related to that thing about the strategies you're seeing working best, you've talked about like the returns rates holding relatively steady, but are you finding customer expectation varies significantly from like country to country or region to region? For example, are the demands of shoppers and expectations in terms of returns policies broadly the same in North America as they are to UK and Europe? Or do you see that vary widely in terms of where customers expect to get things for free versus willing to pay?
Yeah. So this is, I'll acknowledge that if you were to ask me to go a level deeper on the UK policy or expectations and culture, I would fall flat on my face and not be really dialed in there. But we do see, and I'll talk about maybe where we do and don't see differences. Australia, New Zealand, US, Canada, pretty similar cultural expectations, tolerance levels, et cetera. EU and UK, candidly, are sort of like post-submission product market fit isn't nearly as strong as it is in those areas. I believe, based on what we see, is that like the fact that you're crossing so many borders in the EU and the UK based on like point of origin with where the orders are coming from and where they're going back to get to a shopper. That's a lot more complex. In US, there's, you know, USPS, FedEx and UPS, and in Canada, there's, you know, Canada Post and a few others. And I think the fragmentation of carriers and sort of the they're like asset light carriers, meaning like carriers who don't necessarily own their trucks and all of the infrastructure, and that fragmentation plus, like, you take the fragmentation of there are different carriers and sort of first and last mile shippers in all these countries, and then you take the asset light element of it, and we don't have the same coverage to sort of meet those post fulfillment and shipping expectations in those regions, and it's something we're attacking and working with merchants and carriers aggressively on, specifically for the UK. It's a focus area for us to. This will be a quick tangent, but I think that the only way to build great product is to have great empathy for the users of the product. And, you know, empathy requires sort of understanding and experience and being able to sort of touch the flame, so to speak. And historically, we've been so North American sort of centric that we haven't had, I think, an empathy and an understanding for what that post-fulfillment logistics world in the UK is like. And so we're investing heavily in just building a deeper understanding and an appreciation for the merchant and shopper and carrier pain points to make sure that we can solve them effectively.
Great. Yeah, I think there's a lot of demand around Loop in the UK at the moment as well, so makes sense. And I guess kind of on that, what are some of the other features you're working on with Loop? So I've been told by a few different companies that you're working on integrations, globally being a good example, which I think will be massive when you roll that out. But what else are you kind of doubling down on over the next year or so?
Yeah, totally. So we'll put a pin in this one, but we're building, I think to really, well, let me back up. You know, there was maybe a belief that like you could build the right business as sort of a focused point solution in any sort of vertical of our merchants' technology stacks. What I think we're finding is that there's a bit of a critical mass to what we've done in returns. And I bring that up because we're doing a few things, and I'd maybe call out three specific things. One is sort of architecturally, we've been doing this for years, and you know, the over communicated or oversimplified take is like monolith versus services oriented architecture. And Loop started as a monolith where everything kind of happened in this primary main code base. And over the last couple of years, when we've built new things, they've been sort of this microservices oriented sort of architecture. What we're doing now is taking the core of our application, which is like returns and products and orders and all that sort of stuff, and building that into an open sort of an open architecture. And there's like a go-to-market component of that where, you know, we want to be able to work with merchants beyond the Shopify ecosystem, whether that's an established platform like Salesforce Commerce Cloud, or a headless player like Commerce Tools, or a custom solution where you've got an SI who wants to build. And so for our Shopify merchants, we're going to basically start consuming all of our own core APIs in that open architecture. And then we'll have some options to work with merchants who aren't maybe on the Shopify platform today. So there's like that big architectural component. And then I would say, really, there are two other things as we start to move toward being a little bit more of a platform. There's sort of the platformization of our, I'll talk platformization generally, and I'll talk about that in both post-purchase and what I'll call first mile. So post-purchase, you know, for example, we'll end up having sort of a marketplace where anyone can build an application into it and, you know, call it like reviews, for example, Yotpo or Junip or Power Reviews or Okendo. Maybe someone using that platform, or maybe those companies themselves want to say, hey, you know what? If a merchant is getting a 2-star review, I want to enable that customer to deep link into a returns process and return for a product that they're going to love so that I don't get that 2-star review. Or maybe it's a loyalty or rewards program or a membership program where a merchant's paying for access to some membership program. And because you're in that membership program, you get free returns and free exchanges for life and no window. We're now going from sort of like building out custom integrations one-off to having an open platform approach where anything, anyone, any APIs and any service levels anyone could need to build into Loop and you know, create synergy between Loop and other platforms will be feasible. And I'd say that's happening in post-purchase. And it's happening in what we would call first mile. And so making sure that we can offer our merchants the best sort of first mile experiences. So what's it, where and how can I drop off my product? Can I do a boxless drop off, a boxless label-less drop off? Can I drop it in a box? Can I drop it in a, I don't remember what they're called, the UPS or FedEx boxes. What about home pickup? Can I offer those options and building those things in? You know, maybe it's, you know, pick your poison, but creating a platform driven approach there and in 3PLs so that anyone can build in as opposed to building out. And then the last bit, I won't go into it too deeply because we already touched on it a little bit, is the reverse logistics, sort of not just returns initiation, but returns triage and dispositioning, and both being far more deeply integrated into the warehouse to bring those insights and things we learn about items coming back into our merchants' businesses, but ultimately building that dynamic routing layer so that I'm making this up at a high level, but instead of sending 2 million returns a month back to a warehouse where only maybe 30 or 40% of them can be resold as new, understanding that up front and basically separating the signal from noise and making sure that the maybe 500,000 of the 2 million that go back every month can actually be resold and get them back on shelves faster and help merchants avoid incurring cost. So that whole bucket is attacking the cost of returns and reverse logistics. And if I were to sum all that up, you know, Loop's going from this exchange first returns platform to, you know, an ambition to be the world's leading end-to-end returns and reverse logistics platform. And so that's sort of the high level where we're headed over the next year or two.
Hypersonics helps e-commerce companies make more profit every day. This AI-driven platform delivers recommendations for pricing and inventory that lead to bigger profits. Visit hypersonics.ai/podcast to get a free trial.
Excellent. Sounds interesting. Just a few things to work on then.
Just a bit.
Good job you have that lake house to go and have some quiet time in when you
totally
need.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I got a question, Jonathan, around blocking returns. So this started pre-lockdown, and there was some big use cases came out of the US. I think it got a lot of interest in Europe as well. Some big businesses who started targeting serial offenders using automation machine learning tools to find these people and say, right, we're not going to allow returns. Yep. I'd love to know what you're seeing. Is this a growth area? Are more people refusing, you know, bad return, as they're called, which is not a great term to give customers, but not all customers are profitable. Do you have an example of where that's handled well?
Yeah, I'll probably pick on Loop a little bit. We have what we call an allow list and a block list. A block list meaning, and I guess what I would say is that all happens manually. So the way that has to happen in Loop today, it's first isolated to a merchant level. So there is no platform level benefit. Merchant A has a bad experience with the customer. Merchant B, C, D, E, and F can't do anything with it. So right now it's totally isolated, data privacy, stuff like that. But if, Paul, for example, you send back a box of rocks when you said you were sending back $200 worth of apparel, and that operator in the 3PL says, hey, they can basically say this was a fraudulent or an abuse. This shopper abused our policy. We can help merchants automate the adding of in this case, you, Paul, to the block list. And then what happens is the next time you would go to return, you sort of get an interstitial that says you've got to, you know, contact support at hello@brandname.com or something like that to complete your return. We also have the allow list, which is if you just have a great customer and you want to just make sure that no matter what, when and how you want to do it, you can do something there. That said, we're working on two things there. And I feel like I'm repeating myself, which hopefully is a good thing. One is going from like dumb to smart, meaning like right now that's so manual and it almost has to be overseen and set. And we want to be able to help merchants automate that flow and just get people on the right list no matter what. And then second is going from like single merchant to multi-merchant or single tenant to multi-tenant, where we, you know, at our scale, 2 million-ish returns a month now and 4 million in 12 months, every month, you know, we're what's that, 50 million returns a year, and we see every order that's ever been placed on all of our merchant stores. We should be partnering with merchants and their CDPs, whether that, you know, in the Shopify ecosystem is a Klaviyo or a Bloomreach or whatever the case may be, using that returns data to enrich the CDP to change the way we acquire customers, offer shipping methods, offer incentives, offer discounts, et cetera, and taking both returns data and behavior to enrich the CDP, and then the CDP to enrich the workflows and the functionality and returns. And so there's a lot of work left to do. And I think a lot of demand from merchants and a lot of like platform level scale and opportunity that Loop has to be a leader and a transformation agent in that space.
Great. And so last question. So you obviously talk to merchants or brands kind of every day about returns of different levels. For someone that's either, you know, just starting to look at returns in a more sophisticated way, or someone that's looking to generally handle returns in a more mature way, what are some of the key issues you would say they need to be aware of? What are some other kind of bits of advice you have to kind of maximize the effectiveness of the process?
Yeah, totally. I guess where I'd go is hopefully repetitive here in a good way and sharing some mental models and then some specific advice. But, you know, love my Stephen Covey 7 Habits. Like, first things first, focus on automation. Make the experience automated and pleasant for your shoppers and automated and pleasant for yourself and your teams. There's so much you can do with Loop to personalize and to optimize, but like, first things first is just getting the automation in place. Second, I would say if that's first things first, I would say like think long term and build a long term roadmap and like an envisioned future for your loyalty and your customer service and your returns program and know where you want to get over an extended period of time. What I think that looks like tactically is like once you're automating it, then you can start to, you know, make sure you're not biting off more than you can chew. But especially if you're using Loop, you know, introducing bonus credit and seeing how that works and what it drives in terms of shifting from refunds to exchanges, leveraging full catalog exchanges so that you aren't limiting your shopper just to variant exchanges, but being able to, you know, merchants invest so much in their storefronts and optimizing them and their information architecture and navigation and catalog and landing pages. Include that in your returns experience to make exchanges easy and straightforward. What I guess I would say is where I see the biggest transformation in returns and shopping returns experience the next few years is in that first mile experience. And so I'll talk like a couple timelines, and I think this is important. In 2020, 98% of our returns, 99 maybe, were labels printed at home, taped onto a box and shipped. At the end of 2022, about 20-25% of our returns were boxless, labelless drop-off. And when shoppers were presented with the opportunity to do a boxless, labelless drop-off, they were choosing it north of 60% of the time. So 6 out of 10 customers were choosing a QR code boxless, labelless drop-off. And what I see happening is by the time we hit, you know, end of 2024, I think we're going to have seen a complete flip of that paradigm, and 80 or 90% of all returns will be boxless, labelless drop-off, and 10 to 20% will be printing labels. And I bring that up because, one, it's important to know the shopper preferences and shopper demand is taking us that direction. But two, there is a real material sustainability angle there that is important for merchants to be able to leverage and can do it with Loop and our first mile boxless, labelless drop-off partners. But I think, you know, what we're seeing maybe macro outside of returns too is like the disciplined pursuit of less, you know, do fewer things better, buy fewer things that you love more, buy from fewer brands that you really care about. And those as that's happening, and we're seeing that flight to quality in really everything, but in especially in shoppers buying from brands, I do think sustainability in your e-commerce workflows and specifically in returns can be a game changer and a differentiator. And the return on investment for moving that direction for merchants, I think is going to be incredibly, incredibly high.
And one quick, well, I guess it's a relatively quick question. There'll be people listening who think this sounds interesting, but we haven't talked anything about, like, in terms of, you know, how the pricing model works. Could you just give people a quick walkthrough about, you know, what some people might think, or maybe this is only for large businesses. So how does the pricing model, like, what's the entry level?
Yeah. So our smallest merchants, pay us $600 or $700 a year. And if I'm doing the math right, that's, you know, $50 or $60 a month. Obviously contracts go up, and our average annual contract value, just for context, is about $15,000. So a little over $1,000 a month, and certainly go up from there. We stay kind of excruciatingly focused on making sure, I don't know, we've maybe more candor. We've gotten out ahead of ourselves a couple times, and we only did it once, and it was a mistake. We tried to raise prices, or we did raise prices without delivering more value. And we've certainly had to sort of reset our own internal, almost mental model that is like, there is no such thing ever at Loop going forward as raising prices without that increase in price being a small fraction of new value delivered, just full stop. And so that's maybe a philosophical approach. But we have, you know, a flat SaaS fee that merchants can choose. And right now our goal is to provide optionality and be friendly to merchants. A flat SaaS fee, some merchants prefer predictability. They just want to be able to say, I know that returns are going to cost me $500 a month, $1,000 a month. And they just want the predictability of that. And then some merchants want, hey, if I process more returns and I have a heavier return season, I want to pay more. And when I'm using Loop less, I want to pay less. And so in any case, the way we price is largely based on return volume. And we price based on returns kind of moving through the platform. But the model can look different, and we try to accommodate both the merchants who want the predictable fixed fee and the merchants who want to say, hey, I want something a little bit more usage based. And so we've got both of those opportunities.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And if anyone listening wants to find out more or wants to probe on any specific platform features or even look at a demo, how do they reach out?
Yeah. So loopreturns.com is our domain. You can easily consume information and sort of get up to speed on what's possible there today. You can see our pricing. You can request a demo. And then if I can ever personally be a resource, Twitter's probably where it's easiest to find me. My DMs are open. And my handle is my last name, Poma. P as in Papa, O as in Oscar, M as in Mike, A as in Alpha, Poma JP. And so I'm available there, accessible there. I could give out an email address, but you can find me. Loopreturns.com or at PomaJP on Twitter.
Excellent. Amazing. Look, thanks, Jonathan. It's it's definitely a highly topical. There's been a lot more talk recently in press as well around, like, return strategies. And I'm working with a couple of small businesses where they're really trying to fix their returns processes at the moment. So it's an interesting area. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope you've really enjoyed the episodes. Keep an ear open for the next one. We drop one every week. And don't forget to give us that rating on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and share the link as well. Thank you very much, everyone. For more information on this topic, head over to replatform.fm for our audio podcasts. To discuss a project, or if you'd like to chat about any of the topics covered in this episode in more detail, please reach out to myself, James Gerd, or my co-host, Paul Rogers, via LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and keep your ears peeled for the next episode.